Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the new book, Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, The New Global Revolutions, today's guest, Paul Mason, writes, quote, "We're in the middle of a revolution caused by the near collapse of free market capitalism, combined with an upswing in technical innovation, a surge in the desire for individual freedom, and a change in human consciousness about what freedom means." Paul Mason traveled to Egypt, Greece, the UK, and Spain to interview the people behind the uprisings, including the poor living in the slums of Cairo, and the young professionals taking to the streets for the very first time in Athens. He also travels the road taken in The Grapes of Wrath and finds horrific poverty and suffering in the United States. These are the people you rarely, if ever, see on the cable shows. He writes, "The events of 2011 show simply this, that no situation is hopeless and everything is susceptible to change. Against the life-destroying impacts of poverty, inequality, and monopolized power, millions of people now realize the truth of what was chanted in Tahrir Square. When the people decide to live, destiny will obey, darkness will disappear, and the chains will be broken." Paul Mason is economics editor of the BBC's flagship current affairs program Newsnight. He's author of Meltdown, The End of the Age of Greed, and Live Working or Die Fighting. His latest book is Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, The New Global Revolutions. Paul just returned from Greece, where he's been covering that uprising. His latest piece is Struggling Greeks Losing Belief in the State. And Paul Mason joins me here in studio. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on our Friday Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I have to give kudos to a man called Rami Al-Sayed, who is the third person who died in the Syrian city of Homs, together with, as we know, the journalist Marie Colvin and Remy Ochlik. Rami Al-Sayed was a different kind of journalist. He was a citizen journalist. He had posted 200 video blogs of what was going on there. And my colleagues on our rival channel, Channel 4 News, ran one of his reports on the day that they died. There's a little quote here I'd just like to give you. There's only one. He was called Syria Pioneer. They're saying there's only one Syria Pioneer, but there are hundreds of people like him. And because of that, the Syrian government fears a mobile phone with a camera as much as it fears a rifle.
Mm.
And this has changed our profession massively. That what we do in these conflict zones and in the, not so much conflict, but uprising zones that I cover, is we are now very aware that the people involved on both sides are able to access the mass media of a different type, and it changes the way I think we do begin to think about these world events that we're covering.
Talk a little bit more about the significance of the death of these journalists and how it affects media coverage of what's happening in a place like Syria.
I think we have to reserve judgment on what happened until we know, and until the people who were trying to get out, the remaining Western journalists, are out of that city of Homs. I would want to know more about what happened, but there are allegations that the Syrian government targeted the satellite phones that they use. I mean, any military targeter will know how easy it is to target something as powerful as a satellite phone. It seems plausible. There is some evidence coming out that there has been an order to do so. If so, it's a clear breach of the Geneva Conventions and is something that you'd be very worried about. And you have to take your hat off to the people who go in. I have colleagues at the BBC. Many of the Western media are attempting constantly to get in and out of those conflict zones. But look, the Arab Spring, which I've written about in the book, is not over. Its latest episode is the Syrian uprising. And I think that uprising is very much now, it's focusing a lot of diplomatic attention. It's become the focus for stuff that could be a lot more serious than just a social or political overthrow, because it's got the UN divided, it's got Russia and China being pilloried throughout the Middle East for their stance on against intervention. We have all these problems with intervention, of course, because we went through that before. I think at the front line, it's about people dying. And my colleagues who do that, you know, simply to tell the story is hard enough to do when one is in the middle of everything. What I'm trying to say is that everything is given meaning. Mm-hmm. Every dead body, every act of violence or inhumanity is given meaning by the diplomatic situation. It can become a rationale for not intervening or for intervening. And I think the responsibility of the journalist is at least to be there. And that's what Marie wrote and said.
Well, and it's been amazing to read Marie's work over the last couple of weeks. Same with Anthony Shadid. I've been reading a lot of his older articles from Baghdad. Marie Colvin was a 55-year-old American reporter working for the Sunday Times of London. And the night before she died, she was on CNN. She accused the Syrian army of perpetrating the, quote, complete and utter lie that they are only going after terrorists. The Syrian army is simply shelling a city of cold, starving civilians.
Yeah.
What's been interesting about the media coverage is, rightly so, she should be getting so much attention for her reporting. Mm-hmm. But Remy Oklik, he was a French photojournalist, also killed. Mm-hmm. We don't really know much about him.
No, I mean, he's been covered heavily in the French press. I think it's the way the media works. Marie obviously was a veteran and therefore brought a historic, you know, view. I mean, she'd been in Lebanon in the 80s covering that crisis, lost her eye in the Sri Lankan war.
And well known for wearing a black patch.
And I think Remy Oklik was recognized in the French Parliament, in the French National Assembly. Marie Colvin's name was read out in the English Parliament in the same session where they read out the dead in Afghanistan, the dead soldiers. So that I think that at least tells you that people in power are recognizing the importance of journalism in these conflict zones. Albeit, I was just thinking, as you read out her report, the Syrian army would not be the first modern army to shell a defenseless civilian population.
What are your thoughts on where this goes from here in Syria? I mean, the bloodshed is horrendous.
People who know about it, of course, Syria's been a closed regime. It's not so easy to be a Syria expert without being close to that regime. People who know about it say that regime has a lot of resilience. The reason is not just the famous sectarian religious base it's built for itself among, for example, Alawite people, but also because by marriage and by favor, a whole bunch of people in other religious communities have a loyalty. And remember, we saw in Egypt, actually, the ruling elite was able to bend quite a bit. They had a revolution. They got rid of Mubarak. But who got rid of Mubarak? In the end, the people who actually walked into a room and said, Mubarak, it's game over, were army generals. Libya was always going to end as it did. I mean, I think the social base of the Libyan regime was small. But the Syrian regime, I think, has in the eyes of some Syrians, more legitimacy. So the Syria experts say it's going to take a long time. And with Saudi Arabia talking about arming the Syrian opposition, we know from the experience of Libya that arming an opposition comes at a high price, although there's not much oil in Syria. So, you know, at least there's not that incentive.
In your book, Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, you go back to 2009, and that's history now because we move so quickly these days. But you write, nobody had seen this coming, nobody with any influence anyway. The stock image of Arabs in the Western media was of a passive but violent race, often filled under the categories of terrorism. The Middle East specialists in the diplomatic and intelligence communities worked with a scarcely more sophisticated version of the same view. You write that even The Economist, it contained four predictions for North Africa and the Middle East. Sudan would split, Iran's economy would suffer, Iraq would continue to be a headache, and there would be new peace talks over Palestine. But nobody saw this coming.
No. And I think one reason for that is as I say there, I think the paucity of complex thinking in that small but influential world of Arab studies that is always owned by the security community in Western countries. They are the people who pay and set up the fellowships, and it fits a narrative. I quote in the book Edward Said, the Palestinian scholar, who said, you know, in the 1980s, look, there is just an absence of complexity in the understanding of the Arab world. As soon as you are on the streets in a place like Cairo, you are in a place that, look, if you can tune out the Muslim bit of it, if you can tune out the fact that it's Islamic and not Christian, and of course 20% of Egypt is Christian, Coptic, but if you can tune out that, you are actually in, you're in a quite a European-style city, albeit with hugely horrific levels of poverty and corruption. But what I mean is that you're in the modern world. And I think that for some reason, you know, the combination of 9/11 and the repeated wars we've been fighting in the Middle East have reinforced this view, this other view of the Arab world. And of course, it now, I would argue, throughout the Arab world, throughout the Middle East, the social dimension is the most important. The social conflict, the who gets what, class, gender, ethnicity, is far more important than the things that we have attributed to that region, which is the it's been defined by the Arab-Israeli conflict and been defined by the issue of the so-called war, the clash of civilizations. I just, on the street, you don't see the clash of civilizations. I'm sorry.
Well, and also defined by the media. And I think because it's so easy to criticize the media, and rightly so, people often forget how powerful the media really are in shaping our views about different cultures and also just how the media are covering this uprising.
Well, they're not that powerful anymore. I mean, we've just seen in the example of Syria, the way the social media can set the agenda. I'd also say, and I cover in the book, a huge impact was made in the Middle East by the rise of Al Jazeera, and not many people realize that Egyptian TV news tried to copy Al Jazeera, and so it became very popular throughout the region until the moment when they completely caved into the political pressure. So you had then Al Jazeera being a transmitter of social media gathered by ordinary people, a willing transmitter. I mean, maybe because Al Jazeera, I know, has trouble getting onto certain satellites here in the USA.
Right, we still don't have it in most states.
Yeah, I mean, it's hugely influential in the Middle East. And it's as influential as CNN was 20 years ago.
You also write about the power of social media, and I love that you interview so many young people on the streets of Cairo and Athens and Britain and Spain, and you include their Twitter handles in your book. I was thinking about following all of them over the weekend when I have time.
Well, I think, you know, social media moves so fast that maybe by the time the third edition of that book's out, maybe we've all moved off Twitter onto something else. But for the time, that's their identity. Some of their identities are to the world. You know, who is this person? But that, you know, three Arabawi, Hossam El Hamalawi, who is a Egyptian leftist, is known throughout the world because he's been interviewed throughout the world during the uprisings. But I make no apology for comparing the events in Egypt to the events in Greece and to some of the youth uprisings in the developed world, because actually, when you're in there, you always do find what I call the graduate without a future. You find an educated young person who's been very recently radicalized, uses like a sort of, you know, like a native sort of social media, and that social type is there just as much in the cafes on the edge of Tahrir Square as it is in Syntagma Square in Greece.
And I also love that you point out that obviously not everyone is on social media. You tell a lot of personal stories in the book that we often don't hear about. And one of the many stories that stood out for me was the trip you took to the slums in Cairo.
Yep.
For 60 years, you write that the
Zabalin
had run Cairo's trash collection system. They picked up the waste door to door, fed their pigs with the rotting organic matter, recycled the rest for cash, trading with a traditional caste of middlemen. But in 2003, the Mubarak government privatized this program that was actually feeding the poor.
Yeah, I mean, what they did is they handed over garbage collection to multinational companies, and they, in other words, they modernized it. And the people I spoke to said, look, we didn't have dollar a day poverty, despite how trashy, you know, literally their urban landscape is. It's full of flies and dirt, and it's pretty intolerable if you're a weak, you know, effete Westerner like me, full of wasps all around you all the time. Despite that, they never had $1 a day poverty because they could make a living. Only when the multinationals came in, a third of them lost their living. Now, even then, these are Coptic Christians. That's why they have pigs. So they're Coptic Christians, and even then, they were very, very quiescent until Mubarak then finally decided to finish them off by killing all their pigs during the swine flu epidemic. And then they rioted, and then they sent the secret police in. And so when on the day Tahrir began, when people came to them and said, let's go, Muslim and Christian, hand in hand to Tahrir Square, they went en masse.
You quote one of the Egyptian activists, Ab El Rahim Hennaway.
Yeah.
He's a 25-year-old who wanted to reach out to the people in the slums. And he said, we put three things together for the first time, the surprise demonstrations, plus going to the slums instead of downtown, plus the chants. We chanted about economics, not politics. If you're shouting down with Mubarak in the slums, nobody cares. They care about food and shelter. So we chanted, how expensive is bread? How expensive is sugar? Why do we have to sell our furniture? And that's when the people joined in.
Yep.
We had no idea it was going to be a revolution. I thought it would just be a demonstration.
Yep. I mean, so that's, I mean, that is a little vignette of somebody who's been a student activist, and they are, you know, Hennaway, I still see him in my mind's eye, a young guy with a huge beard. Some people mistake him for an Islamist, but he has a big T-shirt saying socialism. And you know, these are the people who were really, they had tried for years to make a little bit of change in Cairo, in Egypt, and instead they made the most massive change. The whole point of writing the book was to ask, why is it? Why is that happening? And I think it wouldn't have happened in normal times. It's the abnormality of the broken nature of the economic narrative. The whole 20 years of neoliberalism and free markets doesn't make much sense anymore when we have such a huge banking crisis still overhanging us. And then the empowerment aspect of social media. And I think a new psychology among young people, that they are powerful as individuals. They've been told that for 20 years. You, the consumer, are the most important person. Well, they say, right, okay, now there's a crisis. I want to choose something different.
We're speaking with Paul Mason about his new book, Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, The New Global Revolutions. Paul is economics editor of the BBC's flagship current affairs program, Newsnight, and it's our Friday Media Roundtable. And we're speaking with Paul about coverage of the uprisings, about coverage of unemployment and the economic crisis. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on coverage of these very large issues? What Paul does in his book is really kind of piece it all together and talk about the similarities between the people taking to the streets everywhere from Cairo to Athens and in the U.S. He actually travels the road of the Grapes of Wrath, and we'll talk about what he found a little later in the show, especially in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And as always, if there was a story you saw this week that you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can post at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. You know, I could talk about the role of women in Egypt for the last hundreds of years. But before I talk about that, I'd like to thank your guest. He's really informed when he mentioned the phony word class of civilization. It never existed. This was the creation of several people led by Frank Gaffney and Bernard Lewis and Michael Ledeen and the rest of the extreme. I just call them for now pro-Israel lobbyists who want to create a class of civilization which never existed. So thank him for that. But the role of Egypt first as the leading power in introducing freedom all over the world was obvious in 1952 by Nasser, which led to the non-alliance group, which he did not want to align himself with the Russian or the Americans. And, you know, this is what created the unity between Egypt, Yugoslavia, India, Indonesia, and so on, many countries. And that did actually pretty much the end of the British Empire as we knew it. Also, I'd like to mention, as a young kid in slums of Cairo, I was more aware of politics than many people today are aware of politics in the United States. In fact, the people aware of politics in the United States and how the new conservative movement and new liberal movement destroyed this country economically. There should be millions of people in the streets of Oakland or San Francisco or Washington and so on. But I'll go to women's role. Women played a big role. The first woman went to college in Egypt was in 1860, and that time Egypt had the best universities in the whole world. But to go to more recent, the 1919 revolution in Egypt was led by women, especially Safia Zaghloul, she was the prime minister's wife, when the British government exiled the Egyptian government, all women took the street, led by Safia Zaghloul. And in that regard, there is a book written by an American author. Her name is Beth, P-E-T-H, Barron. And the name of the book, Egypt as a Woman. And they tell you how actually this revolution in 1919, led by women, it was so powerful that not only the Egyptian government came back, the British reversed their decision, and it was disgraceful, the whole occupation of Egypt, a country far more advanced than England in the 1800s by the British. But not only that, the government was brought back, the whole British troop left the whole city of Cairo, and they just camped around Suez Canal, their prize thing that they wanted to look after. And it really played a big role in the modern history. And I, again, just like to finish by saying that the street man in Egypt is far more aware of politics, not just internally in Egypt, but all over the world, than most Americans are. And that is really shameful, because this is how the Americans get to be victims of the American media.
Thank you, Eid. And thank you for... Eid often calls in to talk about women in Egypt and the role they played.
Okay. And I think one of the things I would add to that is that for poor people in Egypt, the revolution, certainly when I was there, has felt very scary, because at least one thing that the Mubarak government did, and the secret police and the level of repression, was it kept it orderly. The streets were orderly. I mean, I was slightly mobbed by people when I was trying to radio interview people, and I was surprised to be told by my fixers that this is unusual. And the Zabalin people, the slum-dwelling people, what they said to me was, look, I'm scared. Actually, the revolution is scary, because I don't know. A guy pulls out a plastic pass and waves it in my face, whether he's real or not real anymore. And I think that's one of the things we don't see in even some of the best media coverage, is that a real revolution is very complex and very scary, and hard to see where it's going at the time. That is something especially true for women, because those women who've been on Tahrir Square, there is a lot of sexual harassment, and it's difficult. It's difficult.
Well, thank you for calling in again, Eid. Let's go next to Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you, Rose. Paul, I have a question for you. First of all, like everyone else, I'm appalled at the loss of life in Syria.
Yeah.
What I'm concerned about is who's going to take over. And is it going to be... See, I personally believe if you want to stop problems in the Middle East and among Arab countries... Arab countries have to stop it. We have to stop getting involved over there. It's just far too dangerous for us. Let me give you an example of how dangerous it is and what happens. There was a vibrant Christian community in Iraq before we got started in this second war there. It's decimated now.
Yeah.
There's hardly anything left of the Christian community in Iraq. Now, you said yourself, there's 20% Christians in Syria.
Yeah.
Now, what's going to happen to them? What kind of people are going to take over the government? But to get back to my point, if you want to resolve the problems over there, you have to encourage the Arab governments to get involved. Let them deal with their own people or people of other countries that share their religious belief. We are inept at doing it. We can't succeed in that doing it. We can't use this blunt force tactic we've been using. It doesn't work.
All right. Thank you, Roger. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll get a response from Paul right after the break. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we're joined today by Paul Mason, economics editor of the BBC's flagship program, Newsnight. His new book is Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere. He traveled around the world to talk to the people behind the uprisings, and we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on media coverage of these issues? And if there was another story you saw this week, we'd love to hear from you. This is your call, and we'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. We have a free email newsletter. Join more than 7,000 of your fellow listeners who get an email every week or two that keeps you aware of the diverse programming on local public radio, as well as the opportunities to participate in station events. All you have to do is click the email newsletter link on the front page of KALW.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can leave a comment there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Monday, we'll have a conversation about the state of children in the United States. According to the 2010 census, 74 million children live in the U.S., 15 million live in families with incomes below the federal poverty line. We're talking about families who are living off of less than $25,000 a year. So who's speaking for children? They're not being raised in the presidential debates. What's being done to improve public policies affecting children? That's on Monday. And on Tuesday, we will talk about consumer debt. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Paul Mason. We're talking with him about his book, Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, The New Global Revolutions. He writes about media coverage of the revolutions. He goes to Egypt, Greece, the UK, and Spain. He travels the road taken in the grapes of wrath and finds horrific poverty in the United States. He's economics editor of the BBC's flagship current affairs program, Newsnight. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on media coverage of these issues? And if there was a story that you saw this week, we'd love to hear about it. 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment, yourcallradio.org, or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So before the break, Roger was talking about what will ultimately happen in Syria. What are your thoughts?
I think the problem with Syria is it's a fault line in world politics. I mean, it's not just an Arab revolution. And Roger points out quite rightly that there are huge sectarian tensions there that are easily exploitable between the several different religious groups. The Americans or NATO are going to find it very difficult to do a military solution. And I think that Alain Juppé, the French Prime Minister, has said this. Look, we're extremely frustrated. There is no solution. There's not even a sort of mini-micro technical interventionist solution as there was in Libya. And the reason for that is not because it's technically impossible, because glancing at the map on the wall of the studio, Syria has a coastline a few hundred miles from Cyprus where there are UK and NATO air bases. The problem is that Syria is a client state of Russia and is a client state also of Iran. And you're not unless you want to take on the whole thing, you can't do it. No. So it's down to the Syrian people. But I think, you know, the number of Syrian people coming backwards and forwards into London who are part of that revolution convinces me that all you can hope for is that what you might call a secular, democratic, tolerant outcome might be possible. There are parts of the world where you couldn't even see it as possible. I am convinced that a secular, democratic, and tolerant of different religious diversity outcome is possible in Syria, but it has to be handled correctly, I think.
And in the meantime, according to reports, the Russians are giving more than $1 billion in arms to Syria, and the people are getting caught up in this and dying. So yeah. In the meantime, what are the people to do?
Well, absolutely. And we should mention that the Saudi Arabian foreign minister mentioned that they might want to arm the Syrian rebels. And so what do you get then? Saudi Arabian arms generally come with the price of a Wahhabist version of quite fundamentalist Islam and conservative Islam. What do you do? I mean, all you can say is that the young people I write about in the book are, in the Matrix, there's the red pill and the blue pill. Well, you know, there's a third pill, and the third pill is always young people who are just want to live their own lives, whether they're religious or not, but they want to be tolerant of other people, and they want to live a modern, technologically advanced, socially liberal lifestyle. And they exist in Syria, and I think that's the third pill in all these places that avoids it becoming simply a clash of world powers issue. I mean, Syria is in the most danger of becoming a clash of world powers.
So let's move on and talk about what's happening in Greece. You just returned from Greece. Your latest post is Struggling Greeks Losing Belief in the State. Yesterday, the Greek parliament approved the debt swap deal. Greece is getting $170 billion. In return, the government has to implement major cuts in pensions, education, health care. You just got back. You spoke with a lot of people on the streets. What's fascinating about what you write in your book is that so many of the people on the streets are brand new to protesting. Yeah. These are kids, well, young people, I should say, who finished school and wanted to have sort of professional jobs, and they're not available. Yeah. And so they're taking to the streets.
Greeks are a highly educated society with a very strong feeling of humanity and tolerance. And to see 50% of young people now unemployed, really acute levels of poverty. And so in the report I did, some of it which will air, I think, in America this weekend, we see clinics originally set up to deal with migrants and staffed by volunteer doctors to deal with the most poor people who've fallen through the safety net, suddenly swamped by Greek citizens who can't anymore afford even the small amounts they have to pay for healthcare. It's driving people to protest who didn't protest before. It's driving a degree of anger that I think the world hasn't woken up to. But the opinion polls are very clear that there's been a huge swing to the far left in Greece, of the kind that maybe some of your left-wing listeners here in San Francisco and the Bay Area will find very encouraging for their particular politics. But certainly it's stunned the European sort of elite, because they've never seen a swing to the left in the polls like this. Where that goes, I don't know. I don't know where it goes.
You're right. It is apparent the vast majority are not anarchists. Most are not masked. Most are not even young. This is the Greek middle class, the bank clerk, the designer, the concert pianist, the shop owner, the woman with the Gucci sunglasses and the Radley handbag. I've never heard of Radley.
Radley is a very trendy brand.
Okay. Well, we're going to play a clip from the work that you did in Greece. Yep. And in this piece, you are sitting with young leftists.
Yes.
There's no future for us. Generally, there's no future. We can't dream. We can't live. For us, this is the disaster.
But I've been hearing young Greek people say that to me for 3 years now. What do you do about it?
We're fighting. We're trying to convince other people and to make them understand that all this crisis is a result of the capitalist system.
Do you seriously think there could be a left-wing government in Greece?
I don't think it's going to be a non-violent government from the left. It's going to be a civil war.
The carpenter, the teacher, the engineer, the social worker, these are professional people, but the ideas they're espousing have become commonplace. And what it's about is work. There isn't any.
If there's no war, there is a revolution against the government.
And that is a clip from Newsnight, where Paul Mason is economics editor. He just returned from Greece. What, we've had Eric Regulli on, who writes for the Global Mail. Mm. And he basically said he thinks that Greece might have to get out of the euro and that the state could fall. I mean, do you think that that's possible?
Look, I think hearing that is quite sobering, actually, because if you know what the history of Greece is, they had a civil war between the right and the left. They've never had a real left government. Their feelings are running quite high. And I think what is going to happen is this. Look, the bailout has taken place, or it's in the process. Let's hope that all those I's are dotted and T's are crossed. We get to then an election. The two main parties, the equivalent of the Republicans and Democrats in Greece, are New Democracy and PASOK. PASOK's the Socialist Party, but more like the Republicans, really. It's quite a centrist party. Now, PASOK was the government 6 months ago. They failed. They messed up. New Democracy wanted to be the government. About 6 months ago, New Democracy had about 31% in the polls. It's fallen dramatically. PASOK is down to 11%. And this intention to vote left. Now, let's see whether people do. But in the intention to vote left will I think, mess up any possibility of a stable government that can implement what has been signed up to, the levels of austerity. Huge cuts in pensions, huge cuts in pay and pensions. They're not going to do it. And if there's anything like a blocking minority, you know, the way Parliament works, you could get a blocking sort of minority, and the failure to govern by the mainstream parties, that's the point where the default is on the agenda. And I think then Greece is in a place we don't know where a European country goes in after that. We know what happened in Hungary. You ended up with a right-wing nationalist government after a crisis like this. That could happen. I think it's more likely to come up with some kind of a leftist, national-centred policy. But I've studied this story a lot. I've been there on the streets. And as I said in the book, you are now seeing perfectly ordinary middle-class people looking for some kind of solution because they can't stand what's going on. For a lot of young people, it'll be migration. But for the ones who stay, it's unknowable.
How typical are the sentiments we heard in that clip from those young people?
Well, they're obviously not typical of everybody, but they're typical of a lot of young people. Those were left-wing voting young professionals. But the important thing, that was a TV program. The important thing was, you know, these are people with, you know, kind of trendy hairstyles, trendy clothing. They're not the party soldiers of the left. These are people who would not have been leftist. And just to explain what's happening there, those people there, one of the things they do is they voluntarily take food and blankets to the undocumented migrants who cluster in the port they live in Patras, which is a bit like, it's a smaller version of Auckland, container port, ferry port. And the point is, in Greece, the state is now so bankrupt, the state does nothing for undocumented migrants. So they live in an abandoned factory. They live really third world existence. In fact, one of them says to me in the film, man, he says, I lived in Europe. This is not Europe. And I have to say at times, Greece is beginning not to feel like Europe.
We have a caller on Greece. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I'd appreciate it if the guest could give some insight into the question of why, since Greece is a democracy and people vote for the parliament, if the public are dissatisfied with the current structure, the capitalist structure, where you, as you pointed out, they have vacant factories and yet people can't find work, why is it that the people don't vote to replace the government with a leftist government?
I think that, as the polls are telling us, about 40% of them will do, in fact, that. They'll vote for either the communists or a coalition party with Trotskyists and ecologists or another communist party. They will do that. But I think that what people then fear is that the country has a history of dictatorship and civil war in living memory. You know, you can go to a village in Greece and there'll be three coffee shops where the old men sit drinking their coffee, and those three coffee shops are divided along the lines that those men and their fathers fought each other in the Civil War. And my whole theory about Greece and Southern Europe has been that what the European Union did, was throw at the South these cheap loans, the wealth, the easy money, and on the unspoken principle that if everybody has an SUV, it's easy to forget what we did to each other 40, 50 years ago. So the reason why people will take a big, deep breath before, if the choice is put to them in May, and I think it will be, if you vote against the main parties, you're going to have to leave the euro, is because they don't want to go back. Nobody wants to go backwards to the decades of pain they had under the military junta and the civil war.
You also write about the deep distrust the Greeks have for the Greek media.
Yes.
I didn't realize it was so deep.
It is deep. And when you're trying to operate there as a mainstream media journalist, you always get a bit of hassle from demonstrators, you know, because they don't believe they've had the fair shout. But the Greek media really can't operate in those crowds anymore because they believe that the media is owned by rich people who are aligned to one or two. I mean, in normal times, having rich people aligned either left or right to the two main parties is not such a problem. But when the main parties are being discredited in the eyes of many young voters, and when those media are accused of not reporting the reality what's happening on the demonstration, what the police are doing, for example, and in fact being in the pockets of the rich people, then it's hard for the Greek media to operate. And what I found, I mean, in my last trip, me and my camera crew were treated, you know, mobbed a bit, and they tried to take our camera, in fact, on the grounds they thought that we were German. And, you know, that's not a great sign. You know, it's not a great sign to be having to say, no, I'm not German, I'm English, please don't take my camera. But look, most people in these demonstrations in Greece, I keep emphasizing this, are ordinary, non-rioting, very committed and very angry people. And who knows what will happen in an election. One of the other things, for those really interested in the Greek situation, is I think it's quite likely that both the main parties will fragment. Because when you get an election, you get ordinary voters who've been loyal to these parties, to the main socialist and main conservative party, saying, look, we just don't want you to carry on. We want you to change, because otherwise you know, there is no future. I would then say, see some of the MPs, already 40 MPs were expelled from the two main parties last week, and I can see that carrying on. At that point, how do you govern a country?
We're speaking with Paul Mason on today's Friday Media Roundtable. He's author of the new book, Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, The New Global Revolutions. Paul is economics editor of the BBC's flagship current affairs program, Newsnight. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any thoughts about media coverage of the global revolutions, unemployment, the economic crisis, we'd love to hear from you. If you saw coverage this week that you thought was done well on these issues or any other issue, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And because Paul has done such extensive traveling to Egypt, Greece, the UK, and Spain, if you have questions about what he saw on the ground, what he thinks is coming, feel free to give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment, yourcallradio.org, or email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I got a tweet from someone who wanted to give kudos to a piece by Aaron Glantz with The Bay Citizen, Silicon Valley Neighbors Facing Vastly Different Tax Rates. And this is about what high-tech companies are paying on taxes. The tweet says, class sizes are 40-plus and parents teach PE, but high-tech companies freeze their property taxes for 100 years. It's time for Prop 13 reform. So thank you for that. And we'll put a link to that piece at yourcallradio.org. Let's now talk about, Paul, the road trip that you took. You traveled the road from the Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah.
This, for me, was just so fascinating because, you know, Ede called earlier and said, why aren't Americans up in arms over what's happening? We also have an email from, let me just find this email, Rebirani, who says, has your research looked at the unrest in the U.S.? I'm curious why the unemployed and the poor in the U.S. are not protesting more, and why Occupy Wall Street isn't getting much traction with politicians and with a lot of the public. So first, okay, why did you decide to follow the Grapes of Wrath route?
Well, I mean, literally what put it in my mind, of course I'm a big fan of that Steinbeck book, was that there was a drought in Oklahoma. And farmers, of course, now in Oklahoma are big farmers. They're not sharecroppers as they were in the 30s. But it just put it into my mind that it's a journalistic device to go and look at the question of poverty and unrest in America. This was before the Occupy movement had started, although after Wisconsin. And Wisconsin, I think, was a very signal moment for us. We saw Wisconsin and saw, look, even America can do these things. And the question in my mind was, can you find deep poverty and can you find the anti-migrant issues going on just as they were in California in the 30s? And, of course, the answer to both is yes. We went to a homeless shelter in Albuquerque and we found a mixture of people, many people who had you know, problems of social dislocation and addiction, living, you know, on the floor of the dormitory, gymnasium where this Joy Junction place, if essentially a kind of religious 12-step program kind of place, very necessary. But what they were saying to us was, look, you know, we got a new clientele, and that is the dispossessed middle class, people who are being thrown out of jobs, out of homes, having to live in their cars, living in motels. I discovered along that route, you know, The sort of basic motel in America is where the hidden homeless live.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I think, you know, what a lot of the times I do this kind of reporting, I get in both in Britain, both from the right and the left, so both from our conservative politicians and our mainstream Labour politicians, a lot of appreciation for doing this, because I think they realise that being a modern politician does dissociate you a little bit from this world. There's not many votes on the dormitory floor in Joy Junction, and there's not many votes among in Tent City in the migrant jail in Phoenix, Arizona. No votes, in fact, because of the undocumented nature of the people in that jail. So who cares about them? And I think the journalists have to care, even though we have to be quite dispassionate about what puts people in that situation as well. Sometimes it is through actions they have taken. But I think at the end of that journey, I came away asking the same question. Why do the dispossessed not yet act in the way the dispossessed of other countries do? And in my mind, you know what the answer to that is? So many of them have already been through the criminal justice system. I meet so many men, particularly African-American men, who are so angry, but who know that for that anger to boil up inside them is going to lead them into a place they don't want to be. that's where you are. I keep saying, you know, maybe America will get through this crisis without another Watts situation. I hope it does. But if you do end up with another Watts situation, it will be more than just people of colour. There are so many very frustrated people out there. And you know better than I do, because you live here, the nature of policing and criminal justice has changed since the 60s. It's quite hard even to do Occupy.
Yeah, we've done shows about the militarization of the police forces.
It's something that's true all over the world as the crisis has hit. But I notice it a lot here, and I notice, you know, I having been allowed in, had the privilege to go and report inside the Tent City Jail in Arizona, I came away more than convinced than when I went in there that I would never like to be inside it.
Mm. Well, the one thing that really struck me about the people you interviewed in Albuquerque, New Mexico, is most of them brought up war funding.
Yeah, it was interesting.
You spoke to a guy, Larry, who says, how much does it cost for one fighter plane or one bomb? And we're not doing anything to stop terrorism, just blowing people up and pissing off the rest of the world. They're getting stronger and we're getting tired of it. And there's some money that could be cut loose instead of wasting it. One multi-million aircraft could sure feed and house a lot of people. You said this was a common thread.
It is, and it's something you find in England as well. You see, as a journalist, you go out to find a story. And when you're, for example, interviewing protesters, what has caused you to protest about the cutting of your student loan? And so they had the student loans were tripled, so they cut the access to education, is what I mean. And you go and you interview people, and you say why, what's made you go and occupy your college? And what often comes back is the word Iraq. Okay, they did it with these very destructive riots of the kind you don't want to see, among the British poor city dwellers this last summer. I am not a great romantic about riots. I don't think they do much progressive. And when they were interviewing some of the young people, they were saying, why are you so angry? And again, the word kept coming back, Iraq. Mm. Because of Iraq, nobody believes the government. Now, after a while, as a journalist, you just have to actually hear this and not tune it out. And on the floor of that gymnasium in Albuquerque, it was a thing that people came back with. And other stuff. A guy crawled over to me, a Native American, and he said, you know, where's the casino money going? And the stories you find when you are there raise the questions that nobody wants to ask. I think we in the media have a big duty to try and, it's not a question of giving voice to the voiceless, and it isn't about that, but to hearing what the concerns of people are. Because politics filters it out. It does in my country. It's not just America. Mm. It filters it out. And the media is responsive to what the mainstream agenda is.
Well, we have a couple of calls on the line. I just want to take a few in a row, and then we'll get Paul to respond. Right. Let's hear from Harry in San Francisco, and we're almost out of time, so please be brief. Hi, Harry.
Hi, thanks. I'm reading your previous book, so I guess I need to catch up, and I hope some of the journalists in San Francisco are listening to your remarks, which are excellent. As far as, I wondered if you could give a brief description, like how you gather information for a story, how long it takes, and how that process gets put into a book, and whether, you know, what sort of assistance you get on the ground, what, you know, maybe just like one thing that happened in Greece or a brief description of like one day, what one day is like would be helpful.
Great, well, why don't you take that?
Go ahead. Yeah, okay. Well, look, I mean, I'm just an old-style journalist, and I'm very lucky to work for the BBC, who give me the space to do it, to say, you know, get in a car in Oklahoma City, drive to LA and see what you find along the way. A lot of it, we didn't know what we would find. That's old-style journalism, and it's publicly funded. I mean, that's the point about it. And how do I do it? I get out of the car, I get my tape recorder and my camera out, and I ask people questions. But I'm attuned to what the important stories are. And it's not rocket science, and a lot of journalists, maybe there are some journalists listening who are not busy this morning, listening to this, they all want to do that, but the pressures of the modern media are on time, on audience, on popularity. That's the answer. So that's what I was doing in Greece, and it's certainly what pays dividends. If you can go and listen to people, they tell you stories you didn't expect.
Thank you, Harry. Let's go next to Karen in Alameda. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show. Hi, Karen. Oh, sorry, we lost Karen. And do we have one more caller? So in our remaining minutes, Paul, this is your last day in the Bay Area.
Yep.
And so what's your next project?
My next project is probably to cover something that's going on in France, the presidential election there. So they are about to start, and it has started. it looks like Sarkozy could lose, and that's quite important for the European project because the opponent, the Socialist Party, a kind of mainstream politician, similar to Obama, a little bit more boring, everybody says, quite a boring candidate. But he's been talking very left, and he's been using a lot of rhetoric against the financial elite and being very pro-migrant. So we'll see what happens there. There's a third candidate from the Front National, the former fascist party. She's doing quite well. It's very interesting. And the French are, they're angry too. A lot of young French people, high unemployment. They haven't got such a huge economic crisis as Southern Europe. So that's where I'm going next.
Do you spend much time in the States?
I do, and I've, you know, it was no surprise to me to see this level of poverty because I've done Gary, I've done Detroit, Nashville. I spend a lot of time covering those stories, and also my heartland as an economics editor is Wall Street, I'm afraid.
You know, I actually wanted to give kudos, I forgot about this, to your colleague at the BBC, Hilary Anderson, who works for Panorama.
That's right.
She did this incredible 30-minute documentary on poverty in the States. She interviewed children who makes soup out of ketchup packets and water. But we don't really see this much in the U.S. media.
Well, I think you've just got to demand the kind of media you want. The only reason we in Britain have a media that like that, they're capable of delivering that Panorama documentary, is because we have enough money and time and support to be able to deliver it, and that we have an editorial diversity so that one guy does one thing and another guy does something else. That out of it, the editors can put together something balanced and whole, and hopefully that tells the... we try to tell the whole story. I think that's a kind of media you had in America, and there are still parts of the American media that do that. Parts of it are just, frankly, a vaudeville show.
Paul Mason is author of Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, The New Global Revolutions. He's economics editor of the BBC's flagship current affairs program, Newsnight, and you can watch his pieces at yourcallradio.org. Paul, thanks so much for coming
in. It's been enjoyable.
And thanks for your reporting. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your emails and phone calls. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. Speaking for children. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the status of children in the U.S. According to the 2010 census, 74 million children live in the U.S. 15 million live in families with incomes below the federal poverty line. So how has the recession affected the lives of children? How are they coping? Children's issues are not being raised in the debates. So what's being done to improve public policies affecting them? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in San Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, former Chilean President Ricardo Lagos reflects how his country went from devastating poverty to becoming one of the wealthiest nations in all of Latin America. Minister and scholar Dr. Louis Baldwin shares the first and only book of prayers by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a new text called Thou Dear God, and R&B singer Trey Songz talks about his anticipation tour and forthcoming CD on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
Tavis Smiley coming up at 12 o'clock. At 1 o'clock, it's Smiley and West, Tavis Smiley and Cornell West. Coming up next on KALW, San Francisco, your local public radio station from the BBC World Service. It's World Have Your Say on 91.7 and on KALW.org. Stay tuned. The time is 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Nuala McGovern. Welcome to the BBC's World Have Your Say. Are images of the dead taboo in your country?
There are some instances when perhaps it might be less than advisable to view a dead body. But no one can escape the fact that death is inevitable. It's a part of life that should be understood and discussed.
A photo of deceased pop star Whitney Houston in her coffin has been published on the cover of the National Enquirer. and it's led you to debate whether showing the dead in this way is dignified or necessary. You can post your thoughts at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. Now, some of you say it can bring closure. Others say these types of photos are a violation of privacy. Why do images of death make some of us so uncomfortable? And do you think they can serve a purpose? Call us now, country code +44 20 70 83 72 72.